And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited today to be sitting opposite a very, very talented illustrator and artist by the name of Ed Steckley. Ed has been on the morning show at least twice before. We first became acquainted, that is, Ed and I, when he was in the Racine Theater Guild's production of the musical Mamma Mia. But we've also had Ed on the morning show to talk about his wide-ranging career, which included a stint with of doing illustrations for Mad Magazine, for lots of different books, including children's books. And Ed's trophy shelf now includes a Reuben Award that he won back in the fall for Best in Book Illustration. He has visited some interesting events recently. He is going to be at Chicago's Comic-Con later this month. And there are a lot of interesting things going on for him. And it also turns out that he is an illustrator at a time when that whole industry is changing in a lot of really dramatic ways. And we're going to be kind of talking about that as well, kind of the evolving landscape for artists and illustrators. So there's a lot to talk about. And Ed Steckley, I'm delighted to welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. You make it sound like I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think you do.
It's great to be here again.
Yeah, right. So first of all, Your first visit to the program was some time ago, so I don't think it would hurt for us to revisit the point about where you're from originally and at what point in your young life you started to become really interested in art.
Let's put the emphasis on young life, because I'm very young. That's not true at all. I grew up in Racine, and I moved away for college and went to Whitewater, and from there eventually migrated out to the East Coast and lived in New York City for 15 or so years. And recently I decided to make the move back to have a less hectic lifestyle. And I learned that being in Racine is very much like being in New York City. It's so similar.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us, at what point, I mean, were you a youngster when sketching and drawing started to become something you wanted to do?
When I was young, they invented drawing, and no one had done it before. Mm. And I picked up, a stick, and I started drawing in the dirt. And people looked at it, and they went, "Hey, that's really neat. Draw me a circle." And I did. Actually, no, I was drawing as a little kid. I was one of these, like any little kid, I was drawing crayons and stuff. But I never progressed to the point of getting past it. I just kind of kept going. And I think maybe in high school or so, I started to kind of get attention for it, and that's all it took. Mm. And I never, ever thought that there was anything I was going to do that was different. I knew I was going to draw, but I never really thought it through. I knew what I wanted to do. I was a big, huge Mad Magazine fan, and I said, I'm just going to do this someday. And I never thought about it. I never thought of, how do you make that happen? I just assumed, which was naive and stupid, but also worked out in my favor. Hmm. Because had I sat and ruminated over how you go into it, get into this kind of work, I would have driven myself crazy, and I'd probably be a door-to-door insurance salesman by now.
Hmm. So when you went to UW-Whitewater, was it studying art? I mean, were you at least that serious that you were pursuing that academic path?
I studied art in Whitewater, but I didn't appreciate it at the time as much as I should have. But that's where they teach you how to sling paint and how to mix paints and how to do figure drawing and all that. I actually left school in 1995 because I was working. I got jobs as an illustrator. I drew caricatures. I did all kinds of stuff. And so I left a semester shy of graduating. And then fast forward to 2018, I decided that I wanted to have something to keep me busy and spend some extra couple thousand dollars on. I went back and got my degree. So I am actually a UWW graduate of 2018.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was by far the oldest dude in that auditorium that day.
Wow. So when you almost graduated from Whitewater, not in 2018, a couple years before that,
mm-hmm.
you went from Whitewater to New York.
No, I went. I had a couple stops. I did. I would open up retail. Me and a buddy of mine, we opened up retail caricature operations at Six Flags parks around the country.
Wow!
So went to. I did that in Chicago, Great America. Went to St. Louis, did the Six Flags there. Then out to Massachusetts for a couple years, and then in 2000 and something, left all that and just moved to New York because that's where all the clients are. That's where all the advertising is. That's where all the magazines were, and it seemed to be the place to go. Turns out that back in the day, the people that I admired, the comic book people and the Mad Magazine people, they lived in New York because that's where the work was. But the time had come where people could live anywhere. Once you could email and you could FedEx, you didn't really have to do it. But I met a lot of people in New York who are the people that I wanted to meet and learn from. So I have great friends that I met out there that have absolutely made everything worthwhile.
How did you go about meeting those people and sort of finding your way slowly but surely into this industry? I mean, how do you do it? I mean, what's the first thing you do when you get off the plane?
Well, most houses have bushes in front of them. I find that when the sun goes down, you can hunker down and you can put on a cape and you can just kind of sit. Wait, no, that was a different state. Yeah. No, I'm a member of the National Cartoonist Society. And I was on the board of that organization for a long time, up until last year. So an organization like the Cartoonist Society, that's where you meet people, you know. Not necessarily. I wouldn't tell people who are young who want to, well, what'll I get out of joining the NCS? It's not about getting work. It's about meeting people who do what you do and learning from them.
Right.
So because of the NCS, I got to meet all of my heroes and became friends with a lot of them. And that's exactly how it happened. I can trace every job I've done, every cool job, like Mad, books, whatever else I've done. I can trace it back to being a member of some organization where I met somebody who met somebody. Unfortunately, in my field, having a degree makes no difference at all. I've never lost work because I didn't have a degree. It just isn't a thing. If you can do it, you can do it. It's a matter of getting to meet people. It's what you don't do is mail portfolios like the old days. Generally, it's someone knows somebody who can recommend you. It's very frustrating because you can't put your finger on it. It's just, I just have to be present and meet people. Meanwhile, it's a very solitary job. I sit in my drawing board all day in my little studio, drawing away by myself. And, that's all I want to do. And going out and being social, it's difficult because if I'm not sitting at the drawing board working, I'm not getting paid. So, going out and being social and just talking to people, learning from people. Luckily, people that do what I do tend to be very gracious. It's a very gracious group. Illustrators and artists, especially the ones who are established, extremely humble group who are happy to help out people who were new in the industry. And as the time goes on, I've now become one of those guys where, you don't, if someone asks me, like, do you know anything or even though this could be a competitor, you say, absolutely, here's how you do it, because we're all a family. Like, I always say that being an artist isn't what you do, it's what you are. And when you find other people that are like-minded, you just want to boost people up. And I hope I get over that.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ed Steckley, award-winning artist and illustrator, whose resume includes the thing you had dreamed about as a youngster, actually drawing for Mad Magazine.
That's right.
I'm just curious, was doing illustrations for Mad Magazine what you envisioned it would be? I mean, because sometimes when we, as a youngster, dream about something, the reality of it might not at all be the same. I mean, not that it's better or worse or whatever, but certainly a little kid is not going to understand what it means actually to draw illustrations for Mad Magazine. What was it like?
That's very well put. First of all, it was always a thrill to draw for Mad, but when I was a kid, and even growing up, I always had these benchmarks. Well, once I get to this point, then I'll be fine. Then I'll be set for life. When I got into Mad, I learned prior, but it's not a full-time job. People that draw for Mad, you'd open up Mad or a lot of comic books and magazines, like, this is a gig. Each one is a freelance gig. No one who draws or writes for Mad is on staff. We get called for an article. We get called for an issue or a cover. And then once that one's done, well, that's it. Then you're on your own, you know? So you always have to have a lot of irons in the fire. Mad is one where I would pretty much drop everything when they call. Mad is kind of on its way out. It's still published. It's every other month now, and it's mostly reprint material, which, you know, people don't read magazines anymore. But, you know, I recently did a cover for Mad, and that was always a dream, too.
Mm.
So it's one of those things where it's, I wouldn't say it was, you know, a big downer, but realizing that, okay, I have to finish this job in a timely manner. I have to meet my deadline, not just because I want to get another job from them, but also because I have to get on to other things.
Mm.
Because other things, there's jobs I do that pay a lot more. But there's some jobs that pay less, but they're ones that you want to do.
Mm.
So you kind of have to pick and choose. Mad was always at the top, you know.
In terms of jobs you wanted to do.
That I wanted to do, yeah. The amount of hours that goes into a page in Mad, if I were to really crunch the numbers, it would not look good money-wise. Because, you know, it pays, you know, but it's a magazine.
Right.
You know, it's not like advertising or it's not like, you know, other high-profile things. There's no royalties. They can reprint all the material they want. Mad is owned by DC Comics, and it has been for decades. DC Comics has 70-plus years of material that they can do whatever they want with. So an issue will come out, and I'll flip through it, and I'll see stuff from the 50s, 60s, 70s. Sometimes I'm in the new issue. That's kind of neat, but I don't get a check for that.
Right, yeah. That part's not nice.
Yeah.
So what would a gig from Mad Magazine look like? I mean, you know, when you got the call or got the email, what would a typical assignment be for you?
If I drew it, it would look terrible.
I mean, what would they be asking for? That's what I'm asking.
I would be given a script, sometimes an outline, sometimes a finished script, and it would say, okay, this one is involving Ariana Grande, and she's da 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 da. It'd be a gag. Now we need something to sell the gag, you know, the visual. And okay, so what I'll do is I'll work out a really rough thumbnail, basically, of the image with the composition, where the word balloons will go, what's in the background and all that, just to give them an idea of where I'm going. And if that's approved, then I take it, I go tighter on it. I work out the caricatures, work out the hands, work out the figure and the backgrounds and all that, and make sure it's funny. And Matt is very well known for having what they love to call chicken fat in the background. If you open up any Mad magazine, you'll see the visuals there. But then if you look closer, you'll see little gags peppered around the back of, you know, a bird carrying another bird off to jail. Just ridiculous things that are just there it's basically to keep us artists amused. If you're spending hours and hours on an image, this is funny. I'll do this. Maybe no one will ever see it.
Okay.
So I like to fill up the page with all kinds of stuff beyond what the story is being told. So that's a great way to not answer your question.
No, I have some idea anyway. And would the person who was writing this particular story or gag, would they be approving what you were doing?
They have no say.
Ah.
It's all editorial.
Ah.
A lot of the writers at Mad I know personally, and we can talk about things afterwards, but everyone knows that you trust the editors. They know what they're doing.
Interesting.
So, nope, they don't have any say in it at all.
Wow.
Probably good, because you don't want too many cooks in the kitchen.
Right. And if an editor comes back wanting revisions, what would be a typical request from an editor in terms of taking something that was okay, but they thought it could be better if...
If they come back with revisions after everything's been approved, then, you know, it depends on the client. That's when you start to go into extra fees and all that, because I still work on paper as much as I can. Mm. If I don't have time, I do draw digitally. I have the huge magic tablet where I can draw, and it's, you know, those things are really cool now. Mm. But, you know, I have it on paper. So once, but I sketch things out digitally. Usually, if there's time, then I'd rather use pencil and paper and get dirty. But I'll send them a layout and everything that's important, the caricatures, and tell the stories, you know, in a rough way. Once that's approved, I transfer it to a big piece of board, which is about twice the size of a page. And then I start inking. I grab my little ink pen or my dip pen, my ink, and I mix my little ink the way I like it, and I just start drawing. And if a change comes in at that point, well, it really wouldn't. But if it did, I could then, when I'm done, scan it into the computer where I do, for Matt, I do digital color just to save time. And I'm not that great of a painter. I could scan it in and do edits on the computer. Mm. That's absolutely, you know. It's a bummer because you have this piece of original art, which is cool. You know, I've got a flat file full of black and white ink drawings from years. If that doesn't match what's printed, it's just kind of a, you know, whatever. But absolutely, you can make changes after the fact.
Wow.
Doesn't happen much with people that really know what they're doing. But if I'm working for a client that is kind of new or they don't really, you know, then it's a lot easier today than it was in the old days. 10, 20 years ago, when you had to get the white out or the white paint and schmutz things out and redraw them over bumpy paint. Yeah, I could talk about that for a long time.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting to think about how technology has kind of changed this world. We'll get to some other things in a little bit. Mm. So you mentioned before we went on the air today, another gig that has been an important part of your professional life that I don't remember hearing about. I'm pretty sure we've not ever talked about it in your previous times on the morning show. And that is some of the work that you have done for SNL, Saturday Night Live.
Hmm.
So explain to our listeners the nature of the work that you have done for SNL from time to time.
Well, Greg, first of all, the reason I never told you about SNL is because I like to keep an air of mystery about me.
Okay.
And I like to surprise you now and then.
Right. It worked.
I don't know how this started. It was 15 years ago or so. I got a call from the producers or the art department at SNL. They needed some drawing to sell the gag of a sketch. Something, a drawing was needed for a sketch. And I did some drawings for a Robert De Niro movie that I completely forgotten about. There's a movie called Everybody's Fine. It's the one Robert De Niro movie nobody's seen.
Hmm.
And in it, he goes to his daughter's workplace, I think it's Kate Beckinsale, and she works at an advertising agency. And she is pitching, she's doing what Hollywood thinks advertising agencies do.
Hmm.
She's in a boardroom holding up enormous foam core storyboards to sell some products. Now, I did those drawings for that. And I think the timeline works out where that led to this. Everything leads to something else. You know,
sure.
I don't go looking for stuff as much. It's like, oh, you did this? How about this?
So you did the advertising sketches that were utilized in the movie. In that Robert De Niro movie.
Basically, I did the props. Yeah.
Right.
I did the drawings. SNL will call, I don't know, two or three times a year. They'll have some sketch that needs something, some kind of visual. And what's kind of becoming a trope now, and I'm really hoping it becomes a bigger trope, is that the setup of the sketch will be in an ad agency. And someone will go up, and they've got a great idea, and they will sell it. And so I'll do these drawings that look kind of, you know, regular, boring. And then as they progress throughout the sketch, they get more and more ridiculous. Those are great to do.
Mm.
The last big one, I've done a number of these, but the one that really stands out is Owen Wilson was on, and they were pitching him on Cars 4, whatever the next Cars movie would be. And he's reading the script. He's in a sound room, and he's reading the script. And as he's reading this ridiculous, you know, story, the image behind him is my drawing of the storyboard illustrating what he's talking about.
Ah.
And it's, you know, it's a little, it's very un-PC, and that's the gag. You know, like, kids are, you can't say that, you know, this kind of stuff.
Right.
At the end, he decides to do it because they give him a check and all that. Ha ha.
Yeah.
It's a great gag. But the video of this really went viral. It really, it made a lot of rounds because it's funny. You know, it's, I'm not taking credit for it, but I had to really learn how to draw the characters from the Pixar Cars movie.
Wow.
You know, because at the time, well, I mean, I don't have kids. I never saw that movie. So I got a call to do all these drawings about this movie. I had to, and this is on a Friday, and it's due on Saturday, and this is about 30 drawings. So I had to sit at, I don't know, 8 o'clock on Friday night and watch the Cars movie.
Wow.
And really take it in and start sketching from it, because I didn't want to just, you know, copy the characters. I had to get to really learn the characters so I could draw them as, you know, so they really convey as Cars. They had to be sketchy like storyboards, thank God, because it was a really tight deadline. And at the end, I got everything turned in. I didn't sleep that night. And I got everything turned in at, I don't know, 7 o'clock at night and 8, and then watched the show. And it was the opening of that show. So that was a thrill. But the thing is, when that happens, I can't tell anybody, because Saturday Night Live always has a lot more material than they need for each episode. Hmm. So they're constantly reworking things, moving things around in the run of the show, and sometimes it just gets cut. Got nothing to do with me, hopefully. So, you know, I can't tell people, hey, watch Saturday Night Live tonight, because that'll be the one where it absolutely won't show up.
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, which doesn't matter to me. I get paid the same, great. But if it doesn't air, I can't share it. I'm under an NDA, you know, and that's fair. If it airs, once it airs, then I can put it on my socials and do my hashtags and all that. But if it doesn't air, it'll never see the light of day.
Wow. So it goes into a secret file or something.
It does.
Yeah. Yep. And you don't get to talk about
that.
It's
locked up.
Wow. So in a gig like that, so for instance, and I, this makes me want to look up the Cars sketch with Owen Wilson.
I'll send it to you.
That really does sound funny. So how much information would you be given for a gig like that in terms of exactly what these drawings should look like, or what these cars should be doing and so on?
A gig like that, I'll be given a script. And the script will have the writer, it'll name who's in it. And depending on who wrote it, some cast members are better about this than others. They'll actually have art notes. I'd like to see Lightning McQueen, you know, nudged between two other cars, and he's got a snarky look on his face, that kind of stuff.
Mm.
Other times it will be, we're looking for something like this, just go ahead and do it. And the art team at Saturday Live is fantastic, because they understand. They've got a lot going on. They're not going to sit and worry about me. I had to do one a year or so ago. Colin Jost was the writer, and he's the host of the news. And they were doing a gag on a politician at the time who was making news. And the gag was this politician, I'm not even going to bother trying to remember who it was, kind of looked like Colin Jost.
Hmm.
Kind of like cut from the same cloth. So they needed basically what they wanted was like a Times Square or theme park caricature of this guy, but mixed with Colin Jost. It was really hard to do because I draw caricatures,
yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that I'm known for. And to do one that's purposefully kind of lousy,
yeah,
it's difficult.
Ah.
Like, I'm not saying I'm a master or anything, but I certainly know what a leg this is. So I had to tweak it a bit, and I think, well, they didn't have any problem with the face. It was funny and big teeth and stuff, but it didn't look amateurish enough, like a Times Square caricature.
Right, right, right.
And I went, oh. And I still think, you know, I think I did 2 or 3 iterations of it. I still think in the end, it still wasn't quite as successful as it should have been. I should have literally drawn it on typing paper with crayons.
Mm.
But I just...
to make it even more primitive.
Yeah. And the thing about those, too, is I don't get any credit for it. Or maybe at the end I do, I don't know. But I don't sign them or anything. But sometimes I'll put my, I have a little E that I do in my signature. It's three lines. Mm. Sometimes I'll hide it. I'll just kind of put it in there. And I just to see, you know, or just for me, you know. And instantly, my phone will start buzzing. Is that you? Was that you? And
wow.
Like, first of all, people are watching TV live, which, you know, I guess it's all my friends who are old people. But they'll be watching it, and they'll recognize it as something I did, which is flattering. I don't think I have a really particular style to latch onto, but that people are watching and recognizing it and taking the time to call me out, which is just kind of fun. I always get just a couple messages, like, immediately, like, who's texting me at 11:45 at night? And I say, oh, yeah, that was me.
Wow.
It's fun.
Huh, that's cool. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with award-winning writer, artist and illustrator, Ed Steckley. And we've been talking about a number of different aspects of his wide-ranging career, which has included books and illustrating for books. I'm trying to remember, has some of your book illustration been done for books by other people?
Oh, yeah.
So tell us about your entry into that business.
Well, that's another gig where it's like, I don't really, to try to think of how things happened, I didn't go to the publishers and say, I want to work. You know, you meet somebody who knows somebody who has an idea. And
there you go.
I illustrate books that other people have written for the most part. I'm not smart enough to write a book. But I do, basically the books I do are all kind of in the Rube of, in the world of Rube Goldberg. And if you're familiar with Rube Goldberg and Rube Goldberg's machines, if you think of the Mousetrap game, it's a very complicated, ridiculous way to solve a simple task. That's what a Rube Goldberg machine is. And I became friends with Jennifer George, who is Rube Goldberg's granddaughter, when I was out in New York. And one thing led to another, and I got a book to do. So it's a series. The first one was a picture book. It's 15 machines. It's how Rube gets through his day. They're all hand-painted, pretty cool. How he wakes up, how he gets dressed, how he makes his breakfast, blah, 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 all the way through. And each two-page spread is just this elaborate, silly, ridiculous Rube Goldberg machine that you can follow. There's A, leads to B, leads to C, and there's funny text. And that book came out. It's still running, which is great. People love it. And then a second book came out. And then to expand on that world, I had this little Rube Goldberg character. For people who don't know, Rube Goldberg was a real person. He was a cartoonist, probably one of the most successful cartoonists of the early 20th century. Mm. And he did other things besides, you know, these machines, but this is what he's most well known for. So to expand on the world of Rube, I had nothing to do with it. They came up with a series of middle reader books. Got this fantastic writer named Brandon T. Snyder to create a world beyond the children's book world that I did. Now he's got friends. He's going to middle school. Mm. And it's not about the machines. They're really great books about middle school life. Mm. And about, you know, dealing with everybody's got problems. Everybody's got this. One of Rube's things is that he's always got things going on in his head, and he's, I have to build something, I have to go build. And it deals with bullying, deals with all kinds of stuff. But for each of these middle reader books, I did the little drawings that are peppered in throughout. The first book has 55 or so illustrations. Some are quarter page, half page, full page, there's one two-page spread, and the cover. So these are great gigs. And the books are great. So the third of those books came out, of the third of the middle reader series came out in fall of last year. And the second picture book came out previous. COVID worked a lot of havoc with the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. So right now, actually, as of last fall, I don't have any books lined up except for this. The next one is a Rube Goldberg activity book, which I did. I started in fall and finished earlier this year. This is a cool one. It's a huge activity book. It's got 400 plus illustrations in it by me. And it's written by a professional Rube Goldberg machine builder. And it's 25 machines you can build at home.
Mm.
And it's really cool, you know, using paper towel rolls and, you know, a sink and whatever, all this stuff, lawn chairs. And so it's machines that can actually be built which is harder to do because the machines in all the other books, I write. I sit and I come up with funny, you know, cogs to each, you know, part, each step of the machine. And it's a lot of fun, ridiculous. There's a lot of animals in there. Everything still has to conform to physics and work, but, you know, they're funny. You know, it's more about humor than it is working. Yeah. The activity book is all about working. It has to work. You know, how to put flowers in a vase, things like that. Mm. So that book is going to be, I'm really excited about it because the libraries and schools are going to love it. That comes out in November of this year.
Wow.
So that's I guess that makes it 6 books now, all Rube Goldberg based. Mm.
So I was going to ask you who concocts these actual machines in terms of what they actually look like. And so that's you.
That would be me.
You're creating, you're not just drawing them, but you are figuring out all these different steps where these crazy Rube Goldberg machines can work.
This is the kind of thing I tell young artists. It's like when anybody asks me, hey, are you available? Yes. Even if I'm overbooked, yes. Can you do XYZ? Yes.
Hmm.
And then, especially if it's something you don't know how to do, yes, I can do that, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then you go figure it out.
Right,
you know, because tools, like, can you do oil painting? Sure, I can. And you go figure it out. But with Rube Goldberg machines, this is completely outside. I'm not a writer. I'm a drawer. But with these things, I had to learn how to build Rube Goldberg machines. I had to do all of my research. I read every one of the cartoons, and I got a feel for it. And like by the time I finished the second picture book, I really got the hang of it.
Hmm.
And then in these middle reader books, there's a lot of drawings that incorporate Rube Goldberg machines. It's not a part of the story, but they're in there, and they all have to work. So, you know, that one of the illustrations in the first middle reader, I forget, I think it has 5 working Rube Goldberg machines in it.
Hmm.
And the thing about kids is that they will call you on something. If something doesn't work, they get in there and they look. But the picture books even more because they're big and colorful and you can really follow it with your finger. If something doesn't, if something's not right, you'll get called out on it.
Wow.
So you have a spiral, you know, going up a tube and the ball, the spiral, I would absolutely draw it going the wrong way or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you drew it going the wrong way. Yes, I know.
Oh, boy.
And I did that so you could find it. It's called an Easter egg.
Wow.
I forget to draw, like, an arm on glasses. Sometimes if you have these drawings that take weeks to do, I will be the one to forget some stupid, mundane thing. Like, the first book has 2. I forgot to draw the arms and glasses. And kids point it out, and I go, ha-ha, you win.
Mm.
I don't tell them that I'm an idiot, and I forgot to draw it.
You were telling me that your work with the Rube Goldberg machines has led to an interesting connection with Purdue University, and you were just there a few weekends ago for a huge competition there. Just explain what was going on there.
This is one of those things where if you had told me I'd be doing this 10 years ago, I'd be like, what? Okay. The world of Rube Goldberg and STEM and STEAM and science is very much a thing. It's a big deal. And every year, the Rube Goldberg Institute is the official name, rubegoldberg.org. They host the Rube Goldberg Machine Building Contest, and it goes from, I kind of don't know all the ins and outs of it, but basically high schools and colleges can enter, and everyone is given the same task. One year it was screwing a light bulb, whatever. And if teams want to enter, they're given all the parameters that they have to do. It has to have so many steps. It can't do this, can't do that. And then they build it, and then there's regionals, and there's this, and there's all kinds of different tiers of, it's like a sporting event. And then the ones that make it to the very end, I guess the finals, that's a big event somewhere. It's somewhere remote. This year it was at Purdue University. A couple years ago before COVID, it was at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. It's been at OSU. And then all these schools pack up their machines, which are huge and elaborate and great, pack them up in a U-Haul, get these kids to, you know, save up their money to come out and, You know, then they go to wherever this is and they set up their machine, and then there's judges and there's all kinds of stuff going on, and then they run it and it's filmed and all that. For a number of years, the winner of this contest, Jimmy Kimmel, would have the winner on his show.
Wow.
It was before COVID. The last live one was 2019. And so it was a big deal. Yeah. And then they get prize money and all that. And I'm walking around and I'm looking at all these machines that people are. This year the task was put toothpaste on a toothbrush.
Mm.
Sponsored by Crest and Oral-B. And so walking around, I don't know, let's say 20 machines. And I'm looking at them, and I totally get notes from these things because there's like coming up with a part of a machine. You know, how do you get from this section to this section? Got to be something funny in the middle here. I've absolutely gotten ideas from these kids. You know, like, oh, that's a great idea. If I take a rubber chicken and blow it up, and you know, when his tail fills up, that pushes a button over here. That kind of stuff.
Mm.
And I'm constantly reminded that everybody in the world is better at building Rube Goldberg machines than me.
And you just draw them.
I just draw them.
Right.
And I say that a lot to, you know, the kids at these things. They all have the books and all that. And they say, this is really cool that you do these. I said, I just draw them. You know? I don't have to build these things.
Wow. Sounds amazing.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
We're speaking with award-winning artist and illustrator Ed Steckley. And you were telling me before we went on the air that quite a lot of the work that you've done over the years has involved advertising, and a part of kind of the advertising world that I think a lot of us don't have any comprehension even happens. Explain, and we'll get to the fact that some of that has now kind of, that kind of work has sort of gone away because of technology. But, but before that, what would be a typical gig for you with an advertising firm?
One of the dirty little secrets about illustrators, not dirty, it's great, is that a lot of us do, like I said, it's every job's a gig. It's contract-based. So what really pays the bills was always advertising. Comic book people, Mad Magazine artists, you know, all that stuff pays nice, but what really is lucrative was advertising. And so I somehow got into advertising illustration right around 2000, and it was great because that would afford me, like, I would do a nice, sweet, juicy ad job, and that would afford me time to do the other stuff that I really want to do. I could never make a living doing Mad Magazine. Even when Mad was at the height of its powers, it just, you know, unless you're working constantly and you're getting 8, 9, or 10 pages an issue, you're not going to support yourself on that. So advertising, it's perfect. So what I would do, how this would work is I would get a call from either an agent of mine or the agency themselves. They say, we'd like you to come in and help us flesh out this new campaign for the new Canon SLR camera. Sure. So they would book me for 3 or 4 days, whatever. And when I was in New York, I would schlep all my drawing stuff into the city and go and sit and draw. And it would be in a writer's room where people are throwing ideas out. Sometimes they'll have a script. It'll be further along in the process. Sometimes it would be, what do you think? And sometimes I get to actually contribute. And I would just do a bunch of sketches of the ideas that they're trying to do. We need a woman on a park bench, and a bird comes and lands on her shoulder, and then there's a da-da-da-da-da. And punching on the bird, and then this and that, and then bird flies away. Great. And I would spend the next hour or two sketching these things out, put them up on a wall, just like on, you know, TV, you know, put them up on a wall, and then they'd sit and ponder it and da-da-da-da-da. And that was the process to creating either a TV commercial, or sometimes it's a print campaign, sometimes it's non-consumer campaigns for, like, the doctors. I do a lot of pharma, a lot of drug commercials. A lot of the drug commercials you see on TV I had something to do with, and I'm sorry. Which may explain why drugs are so expensive. And so that was always a constant thing. I would, whenever I wasn't, working on something like, for Mad or SNL, whatever, I could always rely on advertising coming in because everybody needed it. And I got to be known as someone who was very fast and could do it and didn't complain. That work in the last year and a half has completely dried up. Even though I live here everything is remote, so I'll just get a phone call. There's a lot of my clients in New York don't even know I moved.
Hmm.
I don't tell everybody.
Sure.
Because I still would rather get my Manhattan rates.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, so I would be at home, and I would just email stuff off and fire it off and blah, 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 and the job's due on Friday. In the last year, if I really thought about it, probably further than that now, that work is completely unnecessary anymore. Nobody calls for it because of things like ChatGPT and any other AI program. The drawings that I would do can now be typed in and constructed with AI, and it costs them nothing to do it.
Hmm.
And in the last year, I'll say I'm sitting there going, where's everybody?
Why is this phone not ringing? Or
yeah,
why are these emails
exactly
not
coming? And I have a big list of emails I send out to people if it ever got slow. And I got a response back, oh man, we're doing a lot of AI. If we need something that is too specific for AI, we'll call you. But, you know. Mm.
So a lot of things that are relatively generic, AI can very easily handle.
Absolutely it can. And I can't blame them.
Right.
You know, it costs nothing. To get someone into to do, I don't know, 100 drawings in a week and then have those whittled down the next week, it's expensive.
Right. And we should also mention that these are drawings that essentially are never seen by
right.
the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that reason, in a sense, their artistic quality
yeah.
doesn't matter the same way it would if this is something that you're putting out in the world.
Exactly.
It's being just used by these yeah. companies, you know, for their own purposes, in a sense.
One of the reasons I got called for advertising work is because I can draw figures. I can draw realistic. I can draw people in an environment, in space, to make it look like, you know, it works. Like, and I know camera angles and all that. And is it a wide shot? Why is it a worm's eye view? All that. And it's completely unnecessary. I'm redundant. So I'm in the middle of this weird phase of my career where I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen next. And
yeah.
this happened quick. It's, you know, if I think about it, the more depressed I get. This is great. But I also know that there's always going to be a need for people that do what I do. I don't know. I didn't know I'd be doing children's books. I didn't know I'd be doing advertising. I was always good at seeing an open door, recognizing an open door. And I'm in one of those crossroads right now where, okay, I'm looking. Where is it? What's it going to be? But
right.
I always know I'm going to be drawing for somebody, somewhere, somehow, and being happy.
Yeah.
I'm no one is luckier than me, except for you, Greg. Because I draw funny pictures for a living.
Right.
You know, even if it's not funny for advertising, even if they're serious, I'm still drawing. And I never, ever took that for granted. It's being put to the test right about now, though.
Right. So you have a little later this month, we'll be heading down to Chicago for Comic-Con, I think.
Yep, C2E2 in Chicago. For all you comic nerds out there, I'll be at Artist Alley.
And tell us what Artist Alley is.
All the big Comic-Cons, New York and San Diego and Chicago, and there's a million other ones. There's always a section that is just artists. And maybe, well, they call it Artist Alley, maybe writers, I don't really know. It's where you can go and meet your favorite artists, and everybody's selling something. I'll be selling books. I'll be doing drawings there. I'll be doing commissions, a drawing of you or you with Alfred E. Newman, whatever. And it's my first one of these things.
Oh.
So I've done Comic-Cons before, but I've always been at the National Cartoonist Society booth, or I've helped out other people. This is the first time where it's just me, and I'm actually building the booth right now.
Wow.
And it is daunting.
Wow.
So I'll be there selling books and doing drawings.
And where exactly is there? Where is this going to be?
It's at McCormick Place, the last weekend of April, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And someday I'm going to buy a calendar and figure out how this works, but it's the last weekend in April, I can tell you that.
Wow. Very good. Well, it's exciting to hear about all of the different things that have been a part of your life and your career.
I like to brag and be exciting and hopefully not put anybody to sleep.
Right. And, of course, it's also interesting to hear about this dramatically altered landscape now in which you and your fellow artists are working. And And it, of course, it would be very interesting to see, as you put it, which doors open up for
Talk to me in a year, adventures. Greg.
Oh, I'm planning on it. Award-winning artist and illustrator Ed Steckley, it's always great to talk with you. This was a really fun and interesting conversation. I'm glad you could join us, and very, very best wishes with everything that is coming, including, I think, a new book.
I have a new book.
So when does the activities book come out?
The activity book comes out in early November of this year, and it's called... God, it's really great. Because the name has changed a few times, so I'm going to get yelled at for that. But it's a how-to Rube book, and it's a lot of fun.
We will watch for it. Ed Steckley, thanks for being our morning show guest today. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Greg.